Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's Greatest Briton is His Royal Highness Caractacus, who fought against the Romans. And my co-host in this series is, of course, Max Musson. Okay, here is Caractacus, the Greatest of Britons. Well, we have got a Greatest Briton that we're going to talk about this week as well. And the Greatest Briton this week is Caractacus, King Caractacus. I hope some of our listeners have heard of him. He's a great British hero from the first century. Have you heard of him before, Max? Have you heard of Caractacus or Caradoc at all?
I have. Yes, I have. Although, to be quite honest, up until we started preparing for this particular program, I didn't know a lot about him, to be quite honest. You know, what I would say is that if I don't really know that much about him, then the chances of many other people knowing much about him are going to be fairly slim. So I think we're going to be educating a lot of people here this evening.
Well, it wasn't always like that. Apparently, he was a very famous character, and schoolboys used to be able to actually recite his speech. I mean, he was that famous because he led the British resistance against the Roman invasion, basically. Well, I'll start with a brief outline. Caractacus was a 1st century AD British king of the Cativellani tribe who united and led the British resistance to the Roman aggression. Before the Roman invasion, Caractacus is associated with the expansion of his tribe's territory. His apparent success led to the Roman invasion, nominally in support of his defeated enemies. He resisted the Romans for almost a decade, mixing guerrilla warfare with set-piece battles, but was ultimately unsuccessful in the latter. After his final defeat, he fled to the territory of Queen Cartismandua, who then captured him and handed him over to the Romans. He was sentenced to death as a military prisoner, but made a speech before his execution that persuaded the Emperor Claudius to spare him, which then made him famous throughout the known world. And this Queen Cartismandua, she was actually related to one of the traitors that actually helped Julius Caesar in the first Roman invasion, because this was the second one. The first time Julius Caesar actually came over, he was gone within 3 months, and we basically defeated him, and he had to go back to France with his tail between his legs, and Rome left Britain alone then for about 70 years, I think it was, 50, 70 years, something like that. And then we get this happening again, we get another invasion, and the actual fighting went on for 35 years. And that's something that Britain should be very proud of, the fact that we kept fighting the might of Rome for 35 years, and we defeated Julius Caesar in the first instance. But just to have a look at the references for Caractacus, because we do actually know quite a lot about him, if you think that he's all the way from the first century. The legendary Welsh character Caradoc ap Bran, which means Caradoc son of Bran, and that's Bran the Blessed, and the legendary British king Arviragus may both be based upon Caractacus, as some researchers claim Arviragus was a title for the Pendragon, or High King, rather than a personal name, with the poet Juvenal referring to him as this. And what would happen when Britain was being invaded by foreigners from abroad, all the tribes would nominate one leader to actually lead them, and he was the Pendragon. And Caractacus's speech to Claudius has been a common subject in art and is often referred to when British politicians wish to appeal to the patriotic spirit of the British people. And I've heard Boris Johnson refer to him, and I've also heard Jacob Rees-Mogg refer to him. So he's obviously still taught about in the private schools. It's just that they don't teach the hoi polloi about him. Caractacus's name appears as both Caraticus and Caractacus in manuscripts of Tacitus, and also appears in the manuscripts of Dio. Older reference works tend to favour the spelling Caractacus, but modern scholars agree, based on historical linguistics and source criticism, that the original common Britonic form was Caractacos, cognate with the Welsh Caradoc. Breton Caradec and Irish Cartac, meaning long, loving, beloved, dear friend. His fellow countrymen knew him as the praiseworthy opposer, and in more modern times as the patriotic harasser of Rome, and his trial and speech were once familiar to every schoolboy. And I was thinking just before we started here that Fanny Craddock, that the surname Craddock, that probably actually comes from this as well. Do you want to comment on any of that, Max?
I would certainly agree with you with regard to Fanny Craddock. I would think that name probably comes from that. A lot of these names, actually, well, certainly Caradoc is more familiar to me as a result of studying geology, where that sort of Caradocian series of rock formations are quite famous, and there's something that we'll probably come on to, which is the Silurids or
Silurians. Silurians, I pronounce it as Silurians. The Silurians.
Which again, Silurian is a technical term used in geology as well, and so those words are more familiar to me from that. But I think as far as our resistance to Rome is concerned, the fact that our very ancient ancestors fought so vigorously over such a long period of time is again testament to the fact that we haven't always been a nation that welcomes invaders or that welcomes immigrants. We have been traditionally a nation that has fought to retain control of our homeland, and fought very vigorously and very ferociously for extended periods of time.
Yeah, we were certainly never an easy conquest. The Welsh still honour Caradoc today. They've got, I think it's called Car Caradoc. They've got places that are named after him. He was a very famous king. He's written about in the Triads as well. Well, Caractacus is named by Dio Cassius as a son of the Catavellinian king Cunobelinus, meaning King Belinus, the Cymbeline of Shakespeare. According to the Welsh Triads, Caractacus is known in the Welsh histories as the son of Bran, because Bran is a contraction of Brennan, which was the word for king. Bran the Blessed, meaning the Blessed King. Do you know much about Shakespeare, Max? I guess we should probably do him at some point during this, but have you heard of Cymbeline of Shakespeare?
I'm not a Shakespearean scholar at all, really.
neither am I. I'm not a big fan of Shakespeare, but at some point I think we will have to look at him. Well, based on coins that have been found, and I actually had a look at these coins, and they're beautiful. I think they're first century coins. It's an eagle with a snake in its grasp. And before we were actually conquered by Rome, we had our own coinage. We'd had that for a couple of hundred years, which shows that we had a very developed, civilized system here. And don't forget, we also had 40 different university cities when Julius Caesar first came here. So the fact that we had these coins shows that we had a functioning modern economical system, basically, with the same tokens of exchange that we use today. But based on the coins that have been found, Caractacus appears to have been the protege of his uncle Epitacus, who expanded Catavellinian power westwards, most likely from his palace in Verulam, Herefordshire, into the heartland of the Catavellani, which I worked out is North London, and into the territory.
Verulam is Hertfordshire. It's if you go to St Albans, there are the ruins of the old Roman town of Verulam, just on the edge of St Albans.
Yeah, and then he worked his way into the heartland of the Catavellani, which is North London. I'm trying to think of the name of the place there. Colchester. That's it, yeah. Yeah, Colchester. He made his way into Colchester and into the territory of the Atrebates, who were a Belgic tribe from Gaul that had actually settled around West Sussex. So they'd made their way north, and Epitacus and the Cativelanians, they had made their way into Colchester. And this had upset the tribes that were actually in Colchester, who again were associated with the traitors that had helped Julius Caesar in the first place. But after Epitacus's death, circa 35 AD, Verica regained some territory, but Cunobelinus's son Caractacus took over and conquered the entire kingdom sometime after 40 AD. Dio Cassius records that Bericus, who was almost certainly Verica, was expelled from Britain around this time during a revolt. Suetonius refers to demands by the Britons that Rome return certain deserters. As Rex or King, Verica was nominally an ally of Rome, so his exile gave Claudius an excuse to begin his invasion in the summer of 1943, and the invasion targeted Caractacus's stronghold of Camulodunum, modern Colchester, previously the seat of his father Cunobelinus. And these deserters, these traitors, it had been discovered that they had helped Julius Caesar, basically, so they fled to Rome, and Britain was demanding that Rome hand back these traitors, and instead of handing them back, Claudius decided that what he was going to do was invade Britain again, basically. Do you want to comment on any of that, Max?
No, other than the, I think the invasion by Julius Caesar took place on the south coast of England, and then they moved inland, and there was a very big battle at the River Medway, which is quite near Rochester, and the sort of local tribe that were involved in trying to repel the Romans was the Canti tribe, after which the county of Kent is named.
Yeah, they didn't get any further than that either. They you know, it certainly wasn't like conquering Britain. They basically made their way a little bit inland, not even past London, and then he was sent packing back to France. And I think we actually succeeded in taking one of his swords off him. There was a shield that had a sword in it that was on display in London for centuries, and it was Caesar's sword. And I think it forms part of the heraldry of the city of London. I'd have to revise on that, but there's quite an interesting story to do with that. But maybe that we'll talk about that another time with the Julian invasion. So we had the Roman invasion. This is the second time, and the Roman army did not want to go, though, remembering the beating they got the last time, saying, quote, "We will march anywhere in the Roman world, but not out of it." Close quote. Narcissus, the eunuch, a free man and favourite minister of Claudius, was dispatched. For the first time ever, a eunuch climbed the general's tribune and addressed the Roman army, claiming that he himself would lead them into Britain. And this insult was enough to get the legions to change their mind and beg Plotius to take them where he wished. Aulus Plotius was the name of the general or the leader that was actually taking them. And they also had Vespasian and Titus with them, who also gained fame for fighting the war in Judea. So we were fighting against some pretty competent warriors, basically. If you think Vespasian and Titus were the ones that eventually took Jerusalem, and we were fighting against them in Britain before that actually happened. Well, Cunobelinus had died sometime before the invasion. Well, that's what Wikipedia tells us. The other reports tell us that he didn't actually die. He handed over the kingship to Caractacus, and he himself actually took a vow of peace, and he became an archdruid. And there's also histories that tell us that then he later on also became Christian. But there are reports that say that he stayed alive. And possibly the only reason why Wikipedia is saying that he had died is because they know that Caractacus was then king. But apparently he resigned, and this was some kind of a tradition that they had, which does make sense if you look at the the Aryan Hindu traditions, when the warriors would renounce their fighting and they'd go off and live in the forest and become hermits and become peaceful. So it does actually tie in that there was this tradition and that the Druids would have it. So Caractacus then became king, and he was then promoted to Pendragon. As I was saying, that we had to have a united leader of the tribes in Britain that directed the armies in these fights. Caractacus led the initial defence of the country alongside his brother, Todgy Dumnus. I couldn't find much else about him apart from what was in Wikipedia. They led the initial defence of the country against Aulus Plotius's four legions, thought to have been around 40,000 men, primarily using guerrilla tactics. And he put up such a strong fight that reinforcements had to be called from Rome, which included the emperor himself and a cohort of elephants, which must have been quite a shocking sight here to see elephants. I should imagine maybe their waste might have scared the British horses as well, seeing a giant horse that size.
Yeah. I had no idea that the Romans did bring elephants to the UK. Actually, that's complete news to me. Yeah, that's a very interesting fact.
Yeah, I think it probably would have been, part of it would have been, you know, the smell of them and the size of them would have terrified the horses. With these extra troops against them, the British lost much of the southeast after being defeated in two crucial battles, the Battle of the River Medway and the Battle of the River Thames. The tribe of the Coritani also rebelled against Caractacus and joined the Romans. So we've got another traitor tribe here. Todgy Dumnus was killed, although John Hind argues that Dio was mistaken in reporting Todgy Dumnus's death, and that he was defeated but survived and was later appointed by the Romans as a friendly king over a number of territories, becoming the loyal king referred to by Tacitus as Codgy Dubnus or Todgy Dubnus. And the Catavellanian territories were conquered. Their stronghold of Camulodunum was then converted into the first Roman colony in Britain, the Colonia Victricensis. So he ends up losing his hereditary lands, and the Romans end up building their colony. And he's also suffered one of the tribes turning tail on him and joining the Romans. And it's interesting to hear that they say that his brother was actually made into a friendly king over a number of territories, and that sort of shows that after fighting, they would accept whoever it was that won the battle, and they would then become loyal to them rather than continuing to fight against them or having partisan warfare or anything like that. They would honor whatever their oath was and whoever it was that had the victory in battle. I mean, they say they had this battle here in the River Medway and the River Thames. Were you saying that was the same with the battle with Julius Caesar, the River Medway?
No, yes. Sorry, I was getting Caesar and Claudius mixed up earlier on. So the battle at Medway was against Claudius.
Yeah, I know they also put spikes in the Thames. I think that was in the battle with Julius Caesar, and apparently you could still see these metal spikes that they put in there at the turn of the last century. I don't know if they still can now, and that was to stop the boats making their way up there. And that, as I say, that was the first time of Julius Caesar, which I think was about 30 BC or something like that. Well, we next hear of Caractacus in Tacitus's Annals, leading the Silures and Ordovices of Wales against Plotius's successor as governor, Publius Ostorius Scapula. 32 battles are recorded as taking place between Caractacus and Vespasian, and they took place in Devonia. So they took place in Devon, according to Suetonius. And as Tacitus describes, the Silures reposed unbounded confidence in Caractacus, enumerating the many drawn battles he had fought with the Romans and the many victories he had obtained over them. So he was having a lot of success in fighting against these Romans, this formidable foe. And the final battle, legends place Caractacus's last stand at either Carcharadoc near Church Stretton or British camp in the Malvern Hills, but the description of Tacitus makes either unlikely. And Car Craddock is in Wales, as I say. I know somebody that's actually been there, and he says there's a lot of local history about Caractacus there, and that was actually the place of his last battle. So there must be evidence outside of the recorded histories that the battle took place there. But Tacitus's record of it says that Caractacus resorted to the ultimate hazard, adopting a place for battle so that entry, exit, everything would be unfavourable to us and, for the better, to his own men, with steep mountains all around, and wherever a gentle access was possible, he strewed rocks in front in the manner of a rampart. And in front, too, there flowed a stream with an unsure ford, and companies of armed men had taken up position along the defences. And that's the end of the quote there. But the fact that he's talking there about strewed rocks in front in the manner of a rampart, Car Caradoc, the fact that it has Car in the name, tends to say that there's something in the form of a cairn there. So there's probably some kind of a fort there that that he actually set up. And that's also in North Wales. So he must have, the battles must have moved from Devon all the way up to North Wales. And if you think his original lands were Camlodunum or near Colchester, this shows you that he had the loyalty of the rest of the British tribes, because otherwise they would have been fighting against him. So he's basically manoeuvring around Britain, battling against the Romans. But Wikipedia says, although the Severn is visible from British camp, it is nowhere near it. So this battle must have taken place elsewhere. A number of locations have been suggested, including a site near Brampton Bryan. Barry Jones in Archaeology Today in 1998 identified Blodwell Rocks at Llanymenech in Powys as representing a close fit with Tacitus's account. But I'm inclined to think it's probably... It was probably Car Caradoc, because why else would they give it that name? And as I say, yes, it's got these rocks there. Do you want?
I think initially the battles that Caractacus had, where he was leading the Silures who came from the southern part of Wales, slowly being beaten back, and he then retreated into North Wales, which is where the Ordovices lived, and so that would tend to suggest a more northerly location for this final battle, in my view. And as far as the Malvern Hills are concerned, I've been to the Malvern Hills on a few occasions, and from my recollection, there is no substantial river running close by them, although they are very steep hills. And they would, I think there was a hill fort on one of the peaks of the Malvern Hills in ancient times, but it probably would have been a very very secure place to make camp, etc. But that doesn't match the description, as you say, of the site.
Well, I mean, it talks about a stream. There flowed a stream with an unsure ford. And then the people that have been researching it have been saying, well, is that the Severn? But it seems to me that if it was just something like a small stream, then that could be lost over the, you know, over the flow of history. If it was just a small stream with a ford, because a ford is just something you can walk through, really. Yeah. It's not it's something that doesn't even need a bridge. So if in Car Caradoc now they don't actually have a stream, then that could just be because of the flow of history, the march of time, basically. We often get accused of, we've just been anti other people, but we're not, you know. We like to praise our greatest ancestors, and one of our greatest ancestors was Caractacus, who we began talking about last week. We gave a brief outline of his life. We talked about the references where we know about him from, Tacitus in particular, and also Welsh references. We talked about the Roman invasion, and the reason for the Roman invasion was to support these traitors who had fled to Rome. It had been discovered that they had actually helped Julius Caesar on the previous invasion. And Caractacus had written to Rome saying we would like these traitors back. And instead of handing the traitors over, Claudius decided to invade Britain. We talked about Narcissus the eunuch, who stood on the general's triumph and harangued the Roman troops because they didn't want to get into Britain. And we should have really pointed out that the fact that they had a eunuch, a favoured eunuch of Claudius, is a symptom of Roman decadence, because, of course, a few years later, that was one of the accusations that Boadicea was making, that the Romans themselves were really degenerate and they promoted degenerate liberal literature. And this is a symptom of it, the fact that they had these eunuchs, which is obviously similar to the transsexual agenda that we see today. And we talked about the first Roman colony at Camulodunum, which was after Caractacus had been defeated. And then we talked about these other battles that he had, I think 30 or 40 different battles. And then we got to the final battle. And I don't know if you want to add anything more to that. Do you remember anything else about it? Or do you want to add any more to that brief outline there, Max?
Not to any great extent, other than just to point out that, we had identified last time that the areas of southern Wales were occupied by tribes called the Silures, and the northern parts of Wales were occupied by tribes called the Ordovices. And it's interesting to note that from a geological perspective, the rock outcrops in those parts of the country are called Silurian and Ordovician rock strata. And so there's a link where those names are carried forward into modern times by the study of geology.
It shows they're honouring the ancestors by naming the geology there around them. And I guess when they were actually naming these rock strata, they were still fairly patriotic. They weren't self-hating like they are now. Probably name them after some imaginary African nowadays. Right. Finally, in 051, Scapula, that's Ulius Scapula, managed to defeat Caractacus in a set-piece battle somewhere in Ordovician territory, capturing Caractacus's wife and his daughter and receiving the surrender of his brothers. So he's managed to capture his entire family here. Caractacus himself escaped and fled north to the lands of the Brigantes, modern Yorkshire, where the Brigantian queen, Cartismandua, seized him while he was asleep and handed him over to the Romans, bound in chains. And in some cases, she's referred to as Cartismandua, and in other cases, she is referred to as Cartimandua. I think it's the Welsh sources that call her Cartismandua. But the apple does not fall far from the tree, since she was the grand niece of the arch traitor who, during the previous war with Julius Caesar, had also switched sides. His name was Mandubratius in the Roman literature and Arvarui in the Welsh literature. And this was actually one of the factors that led to two Brigantian revolts against Cartimandua and her Roman allies, once later in the 50s, and another one in 069, led by Venutius, who had once been Cartimandua's husband. We'll talk about him in a bit. So basically, the British were absolutely disgusted at this treason, and they helped to revolt against this horrible witch that was the queen of the Brigantes, because she had turned Caractacus over to the Romans, who had gone to her for shelter. And while he was asleep, I believe, she put him in chains. Do you want to add anything to that, Max? Have you heard about Cartimandua before?
No, I know that she did Caractacus sell him to the Romans. I don't know of any greater detail than that.
Well, it's quite interesting, actually, the things that are said about her. Well, having given Claudius the greatest exhibit of his triumph, Cartimandua was rewarded with great wealth, and she later divorced Venutius, replacing him with his armor-bearer, Velucatus. And, that's an example of, they say that if you give a woman a chance to decide who she's going to marry the stable hand rather than the landed lord and keep the wealth within the family. So she divorced Venutius and replaced him with his armor bearer. In 057, although Cartimandua had seized her former husband's brother and other relatives and held them hostage, Venutius made war against her and then against her Roman protectors. So she's a very devious person here, holding his brother hostage. He built alliances outside the Brigantes and staged an invasion of the kingdom, where she was forced to seek help from the Romans once again to prevent her from being unseated. So he's managed to get together an alliance with these other nations, these other tribes that are around that area, which shows you just how well-liked Caractacus was and how disliked this traitor was. And she was not so fortunate in 069, taking advantage of Roman instability during the years of four emperors. Venutius staged another revolt, again with help from the other British tribes. Cartimandua appealed for troops from the Romans, but they were only able to send auxiliaries, and Cartimandua had to be evacuated, leaving Venutius in control of a kingdom at war with Rome. And after this, Cartimandua disappears from the sources, but we do have Tacitus to give us an idea of what she was like. And although he refers to her loyalty to Rome, he invites the reader to judge her treacherous role in the capture of Caractacus, who had sought her protection, her self-indulgence, her sexual impropriety in rejecting her husband in favour of a common soldier, and her cunning stratagems in taking Venutius's relatives hostage. So Tacitus is actually very, very critical of her, which shows you that the Romans actually themselves held Caractacus in high esteem because he was such a great warrior and because he had defeated them for such an amount of time. And they saw this woman that had handed him over, their greatest enemy. They saw her not in a very good light because of the way that she did it. So even though they were degenerate and they had these eunuchs, they still, some of them retained an understanding of nobility and honor and saw this as dishonorable. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, what I was going to say is that while lots of people nowadays despair, and probably during the period that we were part of the European Union, despaired that we would ever be able to obtain our freedom from the European Union, and lots of people still despair that we're going to be able to shake off the influence of the New World Order in terms of the way in which it's perverting the course of our politics, the fact of the matter is that, you know, almost 2,000 years ago, we had our ancestors fighting in equally desperate circumstances, and circumstances in which they must have wondered whether they would ever be able to shake off the influence of the Roman Empire. And yet two men, Venutius and Caractacus, came to the fore and were champions of our people. And we just need to take inspiration from the lives of these people so that we retain our positive attitude and continue to work to free our country and to restore the self-determination of the British people.
You've got to have a belief that you can win and you can throw off the shackles of the oppressor. And, you know, this is what we did with Rome. A lot of the time we're taught now that Rome invaded and Rome took over Britain. It didn't happen like that. With the capture of Caractacus, much of southern Britain from the Humber to the Severn was pacified and garrisoned throughout the 050s. But the war for Britain would last a full 35 years in total. And that is a very, very long war to be fighting against the entire might of Rome. I mean, this wasn't a group of backwards farmers. This was, this was a full-on civilization that Rome was fighting against. Well, after his capture, Caractacus was sent to Rome as a war prize, presumably to be killed after a triumphal parade, because that's what they did with the people that the Romans captured. But although a captive, he was allowed to speak to the Roman Senate, and Tacitus records a version of his speech in which he says that his stubborn resistance made Rome's glory in defeating him all the greater. And this is the famous speech that apparently schoolboys used to know off by heart, and that I've heard Jacob Rees-Mogg refer to, and also Boris Johnson. This is the speech. Had my government in Britain been directed solely with a view to the preservation of my hereditary domains or the aggrandizement of my own family, I might long since have entered this city as an ally, not a prisoner. Nor would you have disdained for a friend a king descended from illustrious ancestors and the dictator of many nations. My present condition, stripped of its former majesty, is as adverse to myself as it is a cause of triumph to you. What then? I was lord of men, horses, arms, wealth. What wonder if at your dictation I refused to resign them? Does it follow that because the Romans aspire to universal dominion, every nation is to accept the vassalage that you would impose? I am now in your power, betrayed, but not conquered. Had I, like others, yielded without resistance, where would have been the name of Caractacus? Where your glory? Oblivion would have buried both in the same tomb. Bid me live, I shall live forever in history, one example at least of Roman clemency. And I'll just stop there and just say, I mean, what he's pointing out here, I mean, this is a slight dig at Cartus Mandua, who submitted to Rome because she wanted to preserve her hereditary domains, which is what he's saying here. This is what he could have done. He could have entered as an ally and just been a subservient to Rome and paid the taxes and just been a puppet ruler of Rome. But he refused to do that. And he was the elected Pendragon of all the British tribes representing them. And he was going to defend his country from Rome. He wasn't going to accept being a puppet king. He wasn't going to accept their vassalage. And this, and basically this was the first time that Rome actually had mercy on someone. His speech carried that much weight, and he was such a great warrior that they decided to have mercy on him. Do you want to comment on the speech there, Max?
No, I've got nothing sort of significant to add apart from just to say that it was a very clever speech to make, and one which obviously flattered the Romans and appealed to their vanity, and it worked, and so good for him.
Yeah, it's pretty shrewd, actually, isn't it? appealing to their vanity there, while at the same time also referring to his own greatness. But he made such an impression that he was pardoned and allowed to live in peace in Rome. After his liberation, according to Dio Cassius, Caractacus was so impressed by the city of Rome that he said, "And can you then, who have such great possessions and so many of them, still covet our poor huts?" And he was actually in Rome for, yeah, he was in Rome for 7 years. That was how long he was supposed to actually be there, alongside all his family, who were basically hostages. His life was spared on condition that he never bear arms against Rome again. A residence of 7 years in free custody at Rome was imposed upon him, with the revenues of the royal Silurian domains forwarded to him, despite them still fighting against Rome. Tacitus says, in Britain, after the captivity of Caractacus, the Romans were repeatedly conquered and put to the rout by the single state of the Silures alone. And I find that interesting, that they, although they're still fighting against this tribe, he is still allowed to get the taxes from them, because you would have thought that, yeah, you know, part of this agreement will let you live so long as your people don't fight against them anymore. But I should imagine that, I mean, because he was representing the whole of Britain, I guess there was nobody uniting the tribes of Britain anymore. It was just these single nations fighting against him.
And I suppose from the Romans' perspective, because the first thing that strikes you is that it was very chivalrous of the Romans to allow that to happen. But if you think about it, if the Romans weren't prepared to let that happen, then what would have happened is that the Silures would have elected themselves a new king, and they would have paid their taxes to that new king, who would have been in Wales and would have been fighting against them. But by allowing what they did, then the money that was collected in taxes for the king was paid to Caractacus in Rome, where he couldn't spend it on attacking the Romans.
Very good. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. So the wealth was being siphoned out of Britain and into Rome instead of being spent on arms.
Absolutely.
There. Also, this this idea of hostages. This has gone on for thousands of years. They would take hostages. The same went on with the Saxons and the Vikings. They would exchange hostages. And this is obviously where it came from, was with the Romans. You would exchange hostages and then you weren't supposed to fight anymore. And when we were talking about Alfred the Great, we talked about how the Saxons really weren't very happy because they would do this hostage exchange thing. And then the Vikings would just say, well, couldn't care less about them. You kill them if you want. We're going to carry on attacking you. So, and yet this tradition of, sticking to your oath and exchanging hostages. This is a very, very old Aryan tradition that the Romans were actually showing here. Well, Caractacus stayed in Rome at the Palatium Britannicum with his family for the next 7 years, and the palace actually became the home of the apostles when they were in the city. And there is a lot of evidence to show this. It's not very often talked about. It's not very often referred to. But this Palladium Britannicum, it actually became the Saint Pudentiana, it was actually called, and the Hospitalorum Apostolorum. And it's actually still there in Rome. And the legend is that this was the home of Caractacus. And his daughter was supposedly Claudia Rufina, a British woman known to the poet Martial. Martial describes Claudia's marriage to a man named Pudens, who is almost certainly Aulus Pudens, an Umbrian centurion and friend of the poet who appears regularly in his epigrams. So what we're seeing there is that there's then a marriage between somebody high up in the Roman aristocracy who was living in Britain and also Caractacus's daughter. And it has been argued since the 17th century that this pair may be the same as the Claudia and Pudens mentioned as members of the Roman Christian community in 2 Timothy in the New Testament. And there is actually a stone that was found. I think it was found in somewhere in the south of England in a Roman palace that actually refers to Pudens and Claudia, which again bears out that this is what happened. There are criticisms of this, say, because the daughter's name Claudia, she was originally named Gladys, and they say that she was named Claudia because she was in some way adopted by Claudius Caesar, who became very friendly with Caractacus. But it's a bit sketchy that how true that is, I don't know. There's also talk about somebody else called Pomponia Gracchina, who was apparently in Britain, and she was a follower of a foreign religion. And these two things are used to say that Christianity was in Britain much earlier than it was. But again, Pomponia Gracchina, I mean, it could be saying that the woman is Greek. So there's a question over that. But it is claimed by
Claudia might just be a Romanized version of the name Gladys, because from a pronunciation point of view, if you change the C of Claudia to a G and have it as a Glaudy, then it's very similar to the word Gladys. So it may well be that's the case.
Very good point there, yeah. It's like Claudius, isn't it? Gladys is like Claudius in itself, isn't it? You know, there's right. The C and the G. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. So it could have just been the name Gladys, rather than Claudia, and just the way that it was written. Well, it is claimed by Welsh researchers that Claudia was Caractacus's daughter, and that the historical Pope Linus, who is described as the brother of Claudia in an early church document, was Caractacus's son or grandson. And Pope Linus was the first pope, basically, in Rome. Again, which ties in with the apostles staying at the Palladium Britannicum and baptizing the royal family here, and Linus the son being the first bishop of Rome. Pudens is identified with Saint Pudens, and it is claimed that the Basilica of Santa Pudenziana in Rome, and with which Saint Pudens is associated, was once called the Palladium Britannicum and was the home of Caractacus and his family, and that would make the British palace the first church in Rome, and the first pope a British prince, which is something that they used to make a big thing of in Britain about 100 years ago, but they don't really talk about it that much now. And they're trying to say that... it is, because it formed a part of the Church of England as well. And a lot of the Church of England priests were very interested in researching this, and they wrote quite a few books about it. But it overturns the accepted history of Roman Catholicism, basically. And it also ties in with the fact that when the Saxons came here, it came to Britain, Britain was already Christian. Because in 170 AD, we had a king, King Lucius, and he announced that the whole nation of Britain, everyone in Britain was then a Christian. So you can see that there's a line that can be drawn between this incident happening here with Caractacus and his family, and then 100 years later, all the Britons in Britain naming themselves Christian. And there are references from the 2nd and 3rd century that say that Britain was the first nation to proclaim themselves Christian. So they actually had an established church before the Saxons came over in the 4th and 5th century. Which again gives this long, long history of actually being Christian in Britain, and it was a, it wasn't a violent conversion, as it were. The Druids themselves got on very well with the Christians and vice versa, and the Druids became the arch flamens became the archbishops, and the universities that they had continued, and you had this syncretism between Druidry and with Christianity, which again is not really much talked about today, but it definitely rewards the individual researcher looking into it. I've got quite a few books on it. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
No. A lot of this is new to me, so I'm just trying to take it in, really, I suppose, as I imagine most of our listeners are.
I was looking through my books last night, looking to try and piece it all together, but it's actually pieced together best actually on Wikipedia. I mean, it does talk about all of this on Wikipedia, and I've added some bits and pieces that I've got from the books that I've got. I've never actually read Tacitus, but that would probably reward people to actually have a read of that to try and learn what Britain was like at this time. Because they'll try to tell us today that, you know, they were just backward people and they were just living in wooden huts and they didn't know anything. And that's totally in contrast to Julius Caesar saying that we had universities and, you know, we actually defeated Julius Caesar. He went back, he had to go back to Gaul and he had to try and pretend that it wasn't a defeat, but it obviously was. And then you get to this incident and you've got, you know, fighting against Rome for 35 years. That's a pretty powerful, group of tribes here that are managing to defeat Rome for that long. And then you've got, you know, the way that Caractacus is obviously looked up to very highly to have his palace there and to continue living there and to be given his life. I mean, he's probably the most famous, greatest Briton that we can think of. There's also, just trying to think of the name of him, Bladud, who apparently tried to fly rather like Icarus, and he was a king in Bath, but there really isn't that much information on him. And there's also the guy that first wrote the laws down in 600 BC, Molmutius, and he apparently wrote the laws down. But again, we don't have much information on him. It's just in the Chronicle of Britain. And there's also Lud, where you get Ludsgate from in London. I think he built the wall around London, the first wall around London. And there was another king that built roads, and we had a road that went to the north, to the south, and to the east and the west from the centre there in London. I can't quite remember his name, but there's just little bits about them in the chronicles. There isn't the great detail that we have with Caractacus here. And then on from Caractacus, we learn about Boadicea and leading up to the Saxons when we get to the Venerable Bede, who then wrote the Saxon history and tied in what little he knew about the Britons from before then. So it's really with Caractacus that we really start to get to solid history that we can say, well, this is what happened, because there's lots of reports on it. But it's fascinating stuff to learn. It's much better than learning about black history anyway. I would hope that young people would listen to these podcasts, young Brits would listen to these podcasts to learn about their inheritance and learn about where they come from. It's an important thing to do. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear more from the Greatest Britain series, it is in the second half of the Real Britannia podcast that we do every week on Mondays. Or you can wait and keep an eye out for the edited versions which appear in this Greatest Britons series.